salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to a new episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and our co-host this week is not Vicky, but Natasha Benjamin. So welcome back, Natasha.
Hey, David.
Today, we're happy to be speaking with Nick Raham, a journalist, a commercial fisherman in Alaska for a time, a researcher and Fulbright fellow working with coastal fishermen in El Salvador, Isle Stomping Ground, and most recently, public spokesman for NOAA Fisheries, though I should add, speaking for himself alone today. But before we get into some of your broad experiences and how that's informed your views on different blue issues, it's time for Blue News You Can Use. We've heard about ocean pollution from oil, chemicals, nutrients, and plastic, but in Marbella, Spain, they're cracking down on a different form of pollution, Natasha.
Yes, I just heard that apparently the city council there has decided to impose an $800 fine for urinating in the ocean.
Talk about pissing your money away while you're on holiday. I can see fines for pissing on the beach. Those already exist everywhere, but urinating in the ocean, now it could have serious environmental impacts in terms of it's just a stupid bit of a local ordinance that's become a global media bait. Nick, we won't ask you if you ever pissed in the ocean. Let's instead focus on when you first had your real connection with the ocean. What point in your life was that?
Well, I grew up in New England, in Connecticut and Massachusetts, and I spent a lot of time in Cape Cod and around Musquamica Beach in Rhode Island. And I think I remember I was on Cape Cod Canal in Sandwich, Cape Cod, and I saw like a 5 or 6 foot, maybe it's a figment of my imagination, might have been smaller, but dogfish, a sand shark, just swimming along the rocks. And I really wanted to catch it. So the next day I went out with my dad, get some bait, and I did not catch the shark. But from that time, you know, I grew up snorkeling, bodyboarding, body surfing in the ocean. I was lucky enough to spend about 2 weeks every summer on the Squamica Beach. And there's the Weekapog Breachway that connects the Atlantic to a saltwater pond. And I used to spend hours just snorkeling around the rocks and the jetty, flowing with the current, trying to explore, see what fish and crustaceans I could find. I used to love snorkeling at night with underwater flashlights just off the beach and light it up and see all the fish and different creatures that are really out at night that you can't see during the day. So from a very young age, I spent a lot of time in the ocean and always it was my playground from a very early age. And because the light could be seen from the beach, my parents and family would just let my cousins and I go out as far as we wanted. I was usually always pretty comfortable in the water.
And how did that impact you going on to college? Were you thinking oceans when you were in college or?
No. I started off as a computer science major in college. And I realized I did not like typing code. And so I decided to go into a much more lucrative major, and I became an English major from computer science. Then I realized I should tax something else on top of that. So I started studying economics, and I was always really influenced by ecological economics. The University of Vermont, where I went to undergrad, has a really good ecological economics program. And even their econ department has a pretty heterodox approach. So I was always interested in environmental economics, ecological economics. But through my college years, ocean wasn't particularly my focus.
So how'd you get there?
How'd I get there? Well, I moved to California and started surfing and really enjoyed that. And I graduated from undergrad with like $100,000 in student debt. And I was working at a newspaper in Salinas, and I just couldn't make any student loan payments. And a friend of mine from college, who ended up broke in Seattle a few years earlier and found his way on a fishing boat. And he told me that I should quit my job in the newspaper and start commercial fishing. I could make a lot of money and I'd pay off my student loans quickly. Now, my first go around, I made no money and it wasn't as easy as he said, but this is right around the time of the Great Recession. And I realized, you know, I didn't really like fishing when I started. I started I went down to Southern California to do squid fishing out of Ventura. And squid always alternates between Dungeness crab as the largest value fishery in California. That was, I was very green. And it was a pretty lucrative fishery at the time. So all the openings went to people with experience. And I got a job on a light boat. And light boats are smaller boats that have high-powered lights that shine down into the water that attract the squid, and the squid just rise up to the surface. And it's really cool to see when you have like 100 tons of squid under the boat, and then you have schools of mackerel swimming around the squid, you have birds, and you have larger fish chasing after the mackerel. So it's really quite the sight. And so we're fishing off the Channel Islands outside of Santa Barbara. And you need a lot of electricity for these lights. And unfortunately, there's really bad wiring. And I got crazy shocks that unfortunately killed someone a year later. It's
Wow.
basically a generator was leaking spare voltage into the hull. So if you touch the stainless handrail and grounded on any other metal object, you'd close the circuit and get a
Yikes.
jolt right through you. And
So
then
it's
I
like
got
you're part of the bait ball and the guys with the nets are making the money.
both in terms of environmental impacts and labor concerns, it was quite the eye-opening experience into the world of commercial fishing, because I got fired on that first stint on the light boat because the lazarette, which is a compartment on the back of the boat on the stern, had diesel tanks leaking into the lazarette and then water leaking into the lazarette. So it was really heavy and full of water. We were on anchor off like Santa Cruz Island, and my captain was like, "I got a job for you." And he wanted me to basically take a milk jug, the top cut off, dump this nasty mixture of oil and diesel and water, put in a 5 gallon bucket and dump it overboard. And I did. I was kind of nervous and green, so I did let like one little drop go over, and I saw the sheen, and I'm like, "Oh hell no!" So I told the captain I wasn't gonna do it. He's like, "If you don't do it, you're fired." I'm like, "Well, then I quit." And he didn't bring me to town for like the next 4 days. So I was pretty much stuck on a boat outside the Channel Islands. Finally, I hitched a ride back to Ventura from another vessel.
What
Quite the
an
experience, getting shocked like five or six times pretty badly,
and then asked to
and
pollute the
getting
Channel
fired up.
Islands. Yeah.
Yeah.
What an intro to fishing.
Yeah.
So where did you go from squid fishing? What was the next step? I know you were in Alaska for some time.
I went back to Oakland, just doing freelance writing and waiting tables. And then I got a call randomly from a good friend in Alaska. He's like, "Hey, if you can be in Alaska in 2 days, I have a job for you, fishing for Dungeness crab and salmon, seining for salmon." So I stopped what I was doing, hopped on a boat, and went to Alaska, Wrangell, Alaska. Definitely culture shock at first, coming from New England and in the Bay Area. One of my first jobs out of college was canvassing for Environment California. And after George W. Bush overturned the roadless rule, I was amongst a dozen young environmentalists who went to the U.S. Forest Service headquarters or building on Mare Island with chainsaws, giving the Bush administration a 12 chainsaw salutes for overturning the roadless rule. And then I got to Wrangell, Alaska, which used to be a huge timber town, and the timber industry kind of went away, not just because of the roadless rule, but the roadless rule was finally on the coffin. And they used to have two large timber mills, supported a lot of folks, a lot of jobs, and those both closed, and the population of Wrangell, Alaska went from basically halved in a decade. So it was I'm still supportive of the roadless rule, but it was really slapped me in the face with like what the impacts environmental policy can have on people and on regions and on jobs, and why sometimes there's so much animus towards environmental policy when people see that in a way they might not want through fisheries and through timber areas. You see the social effects that sometimes happen when people lose that kind of employment.
So you were fishing out of there, Dungeness crab and salmon, and how is that? That's a different fishery. That's
Dungeness crab, it's not as big of a fishery in Southeast Alaska as it is on the on the West Coast. It's kind of like a supplement, or at least as I've fished it, a supplemental fishery. So, there's three primary methods to catch salmon. There's seining, purse seines, you have gill nets, and then you also have trolling. Trolling is only hook and line. And all three are done in Southeast Alaska. And you catch a lot of volume with seining. And often you're targeting pink salmon, which is the smallest of all salmon species. And it also fetches the lowest market price. So you're looking for volume in that. And then chum salmon is another species that's we catch a lot of seining. But Southeast Alaska is beautiful. You have temperate rainforest, lots of pine trees, snow-capped mountains, glaciers, lots of bears. It's a really beautiful area in Southeast Alaska. And pretty much during the summers, you are listening to fishing reports and running up and down Southeast Alaska in search of fish.
So this was seasonal work, and how many summers were you up there?
Let's see. So after my first summer, crab and salmon, I actually really did not like fishing and did not want to go back. I had some time. I was back in the Bay Area. I tried to get a job at like some boutique finance firm, and they'd offered me a job, and kind of using my economics backgrounds. But it was a great recession, and I was broke and had bad credit, and they rescinded my job offer because of my credit score.
Wow.
And so I'm like, well, looks like I'm going back fishing. And so I went back to Alaska, and I just kind of realized that it's probably my best opportunity to pay off 100 grand in student debt and just kind of stay focused and start fishing year round. So in the 2010, I started fishing year round for about 4 years. So I did seining in Southeast Alaska, Dungeness crab. Then I went to the Oregon, Washington coast on a Westport to fish for Dungeness crab and back to salmon. And over the years, I've long lined for halibut and black cod in the Gulf of Alaska. I've done fishing for Pacific cod in the Aleutian Islands and the Alaskan Peninsula using the big 7x7 king crab pots. You actually catch Pacific cod with that. I've done albacore tuna fishing out of Washington. Some sardines, anchovies. I worked basically like 4 years straight on a boat. And I was able to pay off my student loans. And then I had a lot of experience so I could be more choosy on which boats I got on, who I worked for, and when. And I got back into writing more and more. So then I went back to full-time journalism after I had to go fishing to afford being a journalist.
You have to do something to afford being a freelancer. I'll confirm
Or
that.
even working at newspapers, I had to can't carry a lot of debt with those jobs.
Well, newspapers and fishing have a lot in common in terms of being an endangered species. But what was your favorite fishery when you were up in Alaska, or a favorite boat?
Seining for salmon in Southeast Alaska is a lot of fun. The physically, it's not the most demanding. There are long hours. You have to be in good shape to do it, but usually the fisheries are scheduled 2 days on, 2 days off. So to manage salmon, especially in Alaska, you're always looking at escapement, which is the amount of salmon that are going up the streams to spawn. So there's no quotas or any limit before the season, but the amount of time you get to fish is dependent on what the biologists are seeing come up the river systems. So if it's a low salmon run, you're not going to be able to fish that much because there's not enough salmon getting into the river systems and the watersheds to be sustainable. But once they start reaching the levels of returning salmon that they need, then you're able to fish more and more. And so you basically don't sleep for 2 days, work really hard, and then go to port. And it's kind of like a big party. I feel bad for some of the residents of those towns having hundreds of deckhands having fun and going out to bars in the towns. But there's a big community in fishing and fisheries, and you get to know people over the years, former crewmates or just people you get to know. It's the community of it I really enjoyed.
As a journalist, you kind of broke one of the rules of that community, or at least you, an article you wrote, Clever Whales and the Violent Fight for Fish on the Line. You talked about that violence and, directed against some predatory activity by some very smart whales. Maybe you could tell us about that article and how long it took to get out in the world.
Yeah, to be direct, in the article, the opening anecdote or story was about a time in 2013 I witnessed my crewmates and captain firing weapons at sperm whales. It happens. It's not common. There are actually two cases. The first two cases I've seen of someone getting arrested and prosecuted for shooting a whale just happened this past year. So it's kind of been the known thing you stay quiet about, but it doesn't happen all that often. Most captains I know don't shoot whales. But I guess the question is, why would people want to shoot a sperm whale?
Right. And his captain used a shotgun. So
it's not justifying it at all. It's really hard to kill a sperm whale with a gun. They're huge.
Right.
And it wasn't much of a deterrent at all because sperm whales didn't stop. But let's get back to why sperm whales are being shot at. It's something that's happening in hook and line fisheries throughout the world's oceans, and specifically longline fisheries. But whales, cetaceans, are learning, often it's easier to eat the fish off hooks than it is to naturally forage. And there's been a lot of studies even just showing the calories that can be consumed, and it's called depredating or depredation. The calories that can be consumed in a few hours of eating sablefish. This is specifically for sablefish in Gulf of Alaska longline fisheries. It's economically efficient to depredate. And it was late February, March, the Western Gulf of Alaska. We were fishing out of Sandpoint, which is basically kind of where the Alaskan Peninsula meets the Aleutian Islands. Terrible weather. And we had worked for about 2 weeks straight and couldn't shake this pod of sperm whales that were just following us. We'd set up dummy gear and do other things to try to avoid them. We'd try to move to different areas. And sometimes you'll even see sperm whales sleeping on the ocean surface when you get to your buoys to start hauling gear. So they know what to look for. And even though a sperm whale's jaw can be 8 to 10 feet long, and sablefish are 18 inches to 3-4 feet, the biggest, they discriminate between what they eat. So if you have bycatch of grenadier or rockfish, they don't really want those. So they can daintily pluck sablefish, or also known as black cod, off the hooks. Sometimes they clean the hook. Sometimes you'll see the hook has been completely straightened out. Other times you'll just have a black cod head. And then they also do what's called raking the long line. So when this being hauled up from the depths, and you fish for sablefish in really deep water, like up to a mile deep. So you have lots of line. And I guess to go back, long lines, specifically in the sablefish fishery, you'll have thousands of hooks and maybe a mile or two of line in one set. And they're anchored to the ocean floor. As they're coming up, sperm whales sometimes will grab the line and pluck it with their mouths and pluck it like a guitar string. And there's video of this. They strum the line like a guitar string, and the vibrations would send all the sablefish off the hooks. And so then they just go around and nibble. So at that point, when the guns came out, this one person said, "Hey, Nick, you need to take this gun and shoot a whale. Otherwise, we can't trust you."
Oh, jeez.
And I was like, well, this is it. But I was doing a job that he couldn't do as well as me. So I don't know how technical I should get into the boat operations, but it was coiling.
But you were in a position to say no.
Yeah, I was like, you can't do this, so leave me alone, maybe later. And luckily later never came. And, but that really struck me. And I had seen before then, again, it's not, I want to be very careful because I don't want to vilify the fishing industry, but I also want to speak really about what happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. Some people see marine mammals like seals, harbor seals, and California sea lions, amongst others, as threats. In some cases, they do impact other species. So I've witnessed folks shoot seals and sea lions in the past, and I had written about it before then. I was very cautious when I came out with this story, and the story took years because I just couldn't find the right outlet. Some folks wanted it to be a little more sensationalist. Like, the story isn't that I witnessed people shoot a sperm whale. The story is why the people would want to shoot a whale, which is around the world, especially after the moratorium on whaling, a lot of whales don't see vessels as threats, but they see them as sources of food.
Well, and also how frigging smart these whales are. I mean, the orcas, sure, but sperm whales don't have the PR of being, you know, smarter than Flipper to target the same exact fish you're targeting. And
Able to calculate how the distance and how much time it was going to take them to get to these boats. I mean, now they're, like you're saying, they're seeing them as a source of food and strategizing on how to get their food source from the fishing boats.
Yeah, and there's some studies have found that whales can do some form of like a cost-benefit analysis. So they have really good hearing. And if they can tell that a boat starts hauling gear and it's hour swim away, then it's worth swimming over to depredate from the hooks. But if it's more than a certain amount of time, the calories it would take to get to the boat to swim there don't justify the effort. So they're kind of doing math in their heads, which is pretty cool.
Amazing. Whale-based economics.
Mm-hmm. And are just sperm whales doing this, or they're finding this with other whales as well?
Well, it depends on the fishery. For sable fish in the Gulf of Alaska, primarily sperm whales, killer whales are known to depredate, especially halibut, and even trolling for salmon in the Pacific Northwest. When folks have just single lines trolling for salmon, orcas might eat the salmon off. It's short-finned pilot whales in pelagic longline fisheries on the Atlantic coast, false killer whales off the Hawaiian Islands and the tuna fisheries, in the Southern Oceans and Southern Indian Ocean. There's been a lot of research around the Crozet Islands, which is a French territory in the Southern Indian Ocean. They have a big Patagonian toothfish fishery, aka Chilean sea bass. And both sperm whales and killer whales depredate in those fisheries. There's also a lot of shark depredation, but I kind of focus my inquiry on cetaceans.
There's so many interesting questions. I mean, are these just lazy whales who see an easy meal, or is it overfishing at a global level? We've certainly got fewer large pelagic fish in the ocean than we had 50 years ago. Are we creating an opportunity for them, or are we creating a necessity for them?
Little both, depending on the situation. If you look at Gulf of Alaska sable fish populations, they're pretty healthy. They fluctuate. You look at what the warm water blob did from 14 to 16, yeah, around those years. I actually saw impacts of that while salmon fishing. It devastated Pacific cod recruitment or spawning, but really helped sable fish. So it's not necessarily a lack of sable fish that's causing depredation. It's more opportunism in some cases. But then for Patagonia toothfish or Chilean sea bass, there was a huge effort in the 90s and it really a huge fishing effort and a lot of illegal fishing, and there wasn't great regulation. So it was overfished. Sperm whales and killer whales did feed on Patagonia toothfish. And so there are signs there that depredation might have led to, or that the overfishing did lead to depredation because there was less food. Off the Atlantic coast and swordfish and tuna fisheries where shortfin pilot whales might eat off the hooks of fishing vessels. It's more environment. They usually feed on squid and the canyons off the continental shelf. And no one is measuring the abundance of that squid. So a lot of times scientists think that it's other ecological conditions that are driving whales to depredate, because tuna are way too big and fast for a short, thin pilot whale to hunt naturally. So they're actually going a step up on the food chain when they depredate tuna, because that's not part of their normal diet.
Have you continued to follow what's going on in Alaska? Because, you know, we've seen a complete crash of the snow crab there. A lot of some places are seeing salmon returns, other places, some of the major rivers and indigenous communities are seeing almost complete loss of king salmon. Do you continue to follow a report on this?
You know, over the past few years, my focus has been more on mangrove fisheries. And also with my day job at NOAA Fisheries, I look at fishing issues in California, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. But We are really seeing a lot of changes to ocean ecosystems. And so I think there's a direct link between snow crab and climate, and their changing of their habitat, their abundance of food, of temperature. They really need ice pack, and when there's not enough ice pack, it harms, you know, their habitat. I was fishing in Southeast Alaska during the blob years. We had the extreme marine heat wave. And so summer of 2015, Southeast Alaska, I was fishing for salmon. And in these salmon fisheries is very minimal bycatch because we really target to where salmon are running. And there's not necessarily any other species within that water column when we set our nets. But we were getting sunfish, mola mola, which are very, they shouldn't be in Alaska. They're very rare. But the water was so warm, they were just off the Prince of Wales Islands in Southeast Alaska. Salmon trawlers from more offshore were reporting that they were catching albacore tuna off Southeast Alaska. It was predicted to be a massive run that year, but it was a complete bust. And some people speculate that that warm water sitting in the North Pacific changed the returning salmon's migration routes because it hit this warm water and be like, this isn't where we should be, and went north instead. I mean, everyone likes to think salmon go back to their original stream all the time. Most of the time, not all the time. Sometimes environmental factors can push them in different directions. So yeah, there's many changes afoot. I mean, as a writer and as a journalist who's covered marine ecosystems, fisheries, and other issues, I like to kind of tell it like it is. And, you know, I don't mind being an antagonist. So I'll call it the fishing industry when things I witness, like fishers shooting whales. But also I've liked to call out ENGOs, environmental nonprofits, who often are sensationalist and kind of have bad faith arguments sometimes. So I've always been in a position where, you know, I've been able to just follow the research and leads and, you know, be in a position kind of in between the fishing industry and some environmental NGOs who I think are might be a little fall into hyperbole. A little too much. But now at NOAA, I can't like focus on those controversies, but I am in a similar position where, you know, fishing industry and some environmental nonprofits are both angry at NOAA. And I respond to it differently, but they were both angry at me before. So it's fine.
Clearly, you're well positioned, having been an environmentalist, a fisherman, and a journalist. You've got that sense of what's real and what's hyperbole.
Well, thank you so much, Nick, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. It was great to talk about everything today.
All right. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Rising Tide, the Ocean podcast, is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by Blue Frontier's David Helbard and Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Houghton Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. You can find Rising Tide at bluefront.org or on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. And don't forget to recommend the Rising Tide Ocean podcast to your friends and other ocean lovers.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.